Okay, we're going to be looking at Psalm 33, and in particular, an application out of Daniel 10, 11, and 12. But before we launch into that, let me tell you about a brand new discovery. A sugar article in here. But it addresses what's called the sugar problem of the origin of life. And, you know, the replicating molecules that make it possible for life to exist, the RNA and the DNA, are made up of these nucleobases that are linked together by phosphates and sugars. And without the sugars, you're not going to get the nucleobases to link together, and you're not going to have replicating molecules. So sugars are critical. The problem for origin of life researchers is that we don't find the sugars, at least the sugars we need, anywhere in the natural realm. The only place we find the sugars are in biological systems or the decay products of biological systems. Now, to put this in context, 5 years ago, a group of astronomers announced that they had found sugar in a dense interstellar molecular cloud. You say, well, what's the significance of a dense interstellar molecular cloud? It's the only place in the entire universe where you can have complex carbonaceous molecules made by natural means. Origin of life researchers gave up on planet Earth decades ago. They quickly figured out there's no way conditions on planet Earth would ever make sugar through some kind of natural mechanism. And that's because we've got oxygen in the Earth's environment, or if we don't have oxygen, you've got ultraviolet radiation, and that will prevent sugar from being assembled outside of biological systems. So naturally, there was a lot of enthusiasm back in 2001 when they announced the discovery that they had found sugar in a dense molecular cloud at the center of our galaxy. The center of our galaxy is where we've got the densest and the biggest of the molecular clouds in our galaxy. And it's a place where they have found 123 carbonaceous molecules, different species of carbonaceous molecules to date. Now, the fine print was this. The sugar that they found was glycolaldehyde. It's a two-carbon sugar. If you know anything about your chemistry classes, sugar is made up of joining together a bunch of formaldehydes, which is CH2O. And so you put a two-carbon sugar would be two sets of formaldehyde put together. But the sugars that you eat in your diet are six-carbon sugars. Those are the simplest ones. A lot of us eat the 12-carbon sugars, but six-carbon sugars are the simplest ones in our diet that we can use. But the sugars that are critical for these replicating molecules are five-carbon sugars. So what was announced in 2001 was that they had found a two-carbon sugar, which is basically useless for the origin of life problem. But there were some astronomers that said, well, if we got a two-carbon sugar, maybe there's mechanisms within that cloud that would make a three-carbon sugar, a four-carbon sugar, and a five-carbon sugar, etc. Well, what has put a damper on this is a paper published in the Astrophysical Journal just a few months ago. And it was a systematic study of the glycolaldehyde that existed in this dense. By the way, there's only one molecular cloud that they found glycolaldehyde. All the other molecular clouds in our galaxy, they can't detect it. And, you know, when astronomers want to find an exotic molecule, they always go to what's called Sagittarius B2, because it's the biggest and the densest of all the molecular clouds in our galaxy. So that's where they go, but this is the only place they found this glycolaldehyde. But in the March 2006 issue, the Astrophysical Journal, a team finally measured how much glycolaldehyde they found. The discovery back in 2001, they just said, we found it. There was nothing in the paper that said how much they had found. Well, with more sensitive instruments, they've now been able to measure how much. Here's the figure. It comes in at 5.9 times 10 to the minus 11 abundance of glycolaldehyde compared to the abundance of molecular hydrogen. Now, molecular hydrogen is the most common molecule in the universe. And so astronomers always measure their abundances relative to this most common molecule. But at 5.9 times 10 to the minus 11, this is an extremely low abundance. I mean, it's basically a little bit more than a trillionth the amount of glycolaldehyde compared to the molecular hydrogen. at such an extremely low amount that the researchers pointed out. We can forget about finding 3 carbon sugars, 4 carbon sugars, 5 or 6 carbon sugars. This is it. We're only going to get the 2 carbon sugars, not going to go beyond that. Well, the latest issue of Astrobiology came out just days ago. The lead article there is the first ever attempt by chemists to actually make a sugar under natural conditions. Now, more than 100 years ago, a group in Europe were able to make all kinds of sugars in the lab, including sucrose, including ribose, the 5 carbon sugars that are important for DNA and RNA. They made all that over 100 years ago. But it was under controlled laboratory conditions that were nothing like the conditions that exist anywhere under natural conditions. And so in the lead article of this magazine, this journal, a group of Mexican and American biochemists decided to see if they could make sugars under conditions that resemble reality. And so they examined the conditions of Sagittarius B2, got the pressure and the temperature and the density of the different carbonaceous materials there, and began to run experiments to see if they could make any sugar. They said, if we can't make it in the lab under simulated conditions, then we can forget about it happening naturally. Well, they were able to make some glycolaldehyde, but that was the only sugar they got from their experiments. So the fact that they only got the simplest of the sugars, glycolaldehyde, the 2-carbon sugar, tells us, once again, we're not going to find any of these complex sugars anywhere in the natural environment. And what really was satisfying about the paper is the level of glycolaldehyde they got in their lab experiments was the same as what the astronomers observed a few months ago in Sagittarius B2. So it told them they were on the right track. They were also able to identify the means by which the sugar was assembled, namely the foremost method. And so they were able to close the book on this and say, for the first time, we understand how glycolaldehyde is made under natural conditions. But that same understanding tells us we can forget about anything more complex than glycolaldehyde, at least anything more complex that's at an abundance level that would have any meaningful significance. Incidentally, the abundance level for glycolaldehyde is so extremely low that it would not have any significance for the origin of life. So what's the bottom line to all this? You're not going to get the 5 carbon sugars through any natural chemical pathway at any time in the history of the universe. And therefore, the only explanation for RNA and DNA is there must be a supernatural, super intelligent designer that made the necessary sugars. Because it's not going to happen under natural conditions, not on Earth, nor anywhere else within this vast cosmos. So, interesting paper, and we'll be reporting about it on the Creation Update. And the very same issue is a similar paper, and it's amazing how sometimes these show up at the same time in the same journal. And it's similar in a sense that a group of researchers decided to take on the nucleobase problem. Now, DNA and RNA, as I mentioned, are made up of nucleobases, 4 different kinds for the RNA, and another 4 different kinds for the DNA. Actually, 3 are shared. There's one that's different for each one. So you've got like 4 different nucleobases that are linked together with these 5 carbon sugars and phosphate groups. Well, this particular research said, okay, we have a sugar problem. Do we have a nucleobase problem? And so they decided to see if they could do the same thing, make nucleobases under conditions that would pertain to chemical reality. So same thing. They looked at Sagittarius B2, measured the physical and chemical conditions there, simulated that in their chemical lab experiment, and tried to see if they could get any nucleobases out. Now, to put this in context, once again, 6 years ago, a group of astronomers announced that they had found one of the nucleobases in Sagittarius B2. Okay, and that got a lot of publicity. What didn't get a lot of publicity is an article published in the Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. You know, a lot of astronomers don't read that journal, let alone lay people. But in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, back in 2003, there was a detailed study of Sagittarius B2, where they concluded that the people who announced the discovery of one of these nuclear bases had misidentified the spectral lines, and in their attempt to find this nuclear base, they said, we can't find it. With greater sensitivity, they couldn't find it. And bottom line, we know that if nuclear bases are being manufactured in these dense molecular clouds, they're being manufactured at an abundance level that's below a billionth of the abundance of the hydrogen molecule. And once again, such an extremely low-level abundance, it would be of no benefit to any origin of life research. Well, this particular study, as I said, they simulated the conditions in Sagittarius B2 in the lab, and they were able to get the simplest of the nuclear bases. However, the same experiment told them that under the conditions that exist in Sagittarius B2, the rate of production of this particular nuclear base is about the same as the rate of dissociation. That's a technical term, which means as fast as Sagittarius B2 could possibly make these nuclear bases, they would be destroyed. And therefore explains why astronomers have not been able to detect the spectral signature of even one nuclear base in any of these dense molecular clouds. And so once again, we're left without any source anywhere, any natural source anywhere in the universe for making the nuclear bases. Well, that kind of just puts another nail in the coffin. If there's no way from a natural process to make a nuclear base or a sugar, you really are in trouble. You're not going to pull these replicating molecules together. And without the replicating molecules, there's no way to store information or transfer information or to reproduce. And therefore, living things would not be possible. And therefore, we would need a supernatural explanation for the origin of life. Well, I'm going to stop there. There's actually a third paper here. This is kind of fascinating. There's three papers published here, back to back to back, and all of them are devastating for a naturalistic origin of life model and establish that there must be a supernatural explanation. I'll save the next one when I come back to join you 2 weeks from today. So I can whet your curiosity a little bit. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, don't. No, they can do that. The challenge is to make it cheap. So, I mean, it's fairly routine to make these sugars in the lab. But the reason why you don't see them in the supermarket is because, unlike plants, it's very expensive to artificially make them in the lab. And so, you'll pay. Well, I don't think you got the resources, but and if you do, I got better places for you to put those resources. Okay. Psalm 33. This is one of the creation psalms we've been looking at. Those of you that are new to the class, we've been step by step going through the different chapter length or longer creation accounts we find in the Bible. And we're roughly halfway through our study of these creation accounts that are in the Bible. And Psalm 33 is one of the shorter of these creation accounts. And I'm just going to look at a piece of it because we really want to jump into our study in Daniel. And Psalm 33, starting off in verse 5, by the word of the Lord were the heavens made, their starry host by the breath of his mouth. Let all the people of the world revere him for what he has done in the physical realm. For he spoke and it came to be. He commanded and it stood firm. And a lot of what we've been doing these past couple of years is looking at what the Bible says about physical creation, how science has confirmed it, and as Psalm 33 points out, this establishes we're dealing with a creator that's in total control of the natural realm. Nothing happens in the physics and the chemistry of the universe outside of his control, He's given us plenty of evidence for his supernatural intervention. And thanks to astrobiology, the June issue, we have even more evidence than we had last week when I talked to you about this. But verse 10, the Lord foils the plans of the nations. He thwarts the purposes of the peoples. The plans of the Lord stand firm forever, the purposes of his heart through all generations. And the point of this particular two verses is that just as God is in total control of the created realm, the natural realm, and supernaturally intervenes to bring about the changes and effects he wants in the natural realm, he does the same thing in the affairs of human beings and the affairs of nations and kings and queens and rulers. And we looked at some passages in the book of Proverbs which talks about how God controls our actions, even though we're kind of making decisions. It talks about how we have our free will. We decide the path we want to go, but God determines our steps. So we make a conscious decision, we're going to do X, but God says, no, I really want your steps to go over to Y, and we wind up doing Y instead of doing X. And if you're old enough like me, you've probably had a few experiences in your life where you can say, yeah, I really wanted to go in that direction, but I wound up going that direction in spite of myself. That's God working within you. And we didn't get into a debate on free will and predestination. We did that about 25 years ago in this class. It took 9 months to resolve that. I'm not going to repeat that. If you want to get into that, we do have a book here on the table called Beyond the Cosmos, which has several chapters on how to resolve the paradox of God giving us complete freedom to choose. And yet at the same time, it's a God that predetermines every thought we think, every word we speak, and every action we perform. And he actually predetermined all that before he created the universe. So it's kind of humbling to think that 14 billion years ago, God had determined everything that would happen in your life from the day you're born to the day you die. As the psalm points out, he's even got the day of your death on the calendar. May not be in your calendar, but in his calendar, he's got that day where he says it's time to go on. And, my wife's mother is in a rest home, and it's filled with these people that are living out their last days. And I heard when we visited Kathy's mom a couple of nights ago that they have a cat there. And it was on the news. Right, right. And, well, you've heard about that cat. Okay. Well, it's a cat that seems to know when it's time for somebody to die. And when it's time for somebody to die, the cat goes into the room and puts himself up on the bed of the one that's dying and comforts that person during those last few hours. So naturally, the cat has got a nickname. They call it the Grim Reaper. And, you know, this conversation was going on. This is rather large rest home facility, and the conversation is going on that the last thing you want to see walking into your room is that cat. So evidently God's not the only one that knows the day that you're going to die, or these animals that do that. And actually, we had an animal like that in our home. Not that he knew we were going to die, but every time one of our boys was starting to get sick, the cat would just hover right around that boy and stick with that son of ours until the son got well. And would literally sleep right on our son's neck and just be there to comfort them. You know, these animals are amazing. And it's something we're going to study when we did Job 39, how God purposely designed birds and mammals to serve humanity and to please humanity. If our sin doesn't get in the way. So if sin doesn't get in the way, and maybe that's the key with this rest home facility, is that people are so incapacitated that their sin really doesn't interfere much, and animals can behave like they really were designed by God to behave. Anyway, moving on. What I want to do today is to continue our study in Daniel. Because Daniel 10, 11, and 12 is probably one of two or three places in the Bible where you can most definitively document that God is in total control of the history and the politics of human affairs. And what you see in Daniel 10, 11, and 12 is Daniel having a visit from an angel. And the angel tells him that he is in a fight with demons. So there's the good angels and the evil angels, and they're in battle with one another over the hearts of human rulers. And, God's angels are winning and preventing the evil angels from directing the king. So if you can imagine, here's a king over a powerful kingdom. He's got a demon trying to tell him to do X, and he's got one of God's angels telling him to do Y, and there's this battle going on. And the message that Daniel was getting from the angel is, you human beings think that you're the ones in charge of politics. You're not. This is a huge angelic war going on behind the scene, and you're no more in control than... So anyway, let's look at Daniel and see what it's got to say here. And the first thing Daniel has been told is that, by the way, the angel comes to Daniel to tell him what will happen in the future as a direct response to prayer and fasting. And as I mentioned last week, this is not your typical kind of fast. He did not fast from food, but for 3 weeks he fasted from luxury foods and luxury activities, and used the time that he gained by avoiding those kinds of activities and food and drink to focus on praying unto the Lord. And for 3 weeks he prayed. And what does the angel tell him? We heard you the first moment you started to pray, and we intended to come to you at that first moment. But we were delayed because of powerful demons, and we had to do battle with these demons first before we could be released to come and visit you. But we heard your prayers all along. You know, and that's comforting, because sometimes we pray day after day, month after month, and we say, what's going on here? And Daniel was told, your prayers were heard the very first moment you gave them, and it was our intent to respond to them. But now I've come to visit you. And what he does is he reveals to him what is written in the Book of Truth. And this is the only place in the Bible that you find this reference to this Book of Truth. But it's mentioned several times here in the passage. And this Book of Truth evidently is a record of everything that God intends to do in the future affairs of humanity. So there again is a message of comfort. Are you worried about who's going to become president in 2008? It's already recorded in God's Book of Truth. He's already selected the candidate. And this is why Paul tells us in the book of Romans that we are not to speak evil of our leader, because our leader was chosen by God himself. Now, the leader might do dumb things. All leaders do dumb things. Anybody in leadership does dumb things. I have to keep reminding my sons of that. That just because I'm their father doesn't mean I won't do dumb things. That happens. But God is in control. He's even in control of the dumb things that our president and prime ministers do. So there's some comfort in that as well. I think you can think about that over the past several presidents we've had. Anyway, let me get to this. And again, as I mentioned last week, Daniel has been devastating to the skeptics, because the skeptics have responded to these three chapters by saying, well, this isn't fulfilled prophecy. This book of truth isn't anything special. Daniel is simply writing from hindsight and telling us what had happened. This is not the Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar's court or the Daniel of Darius the Mede. Rather, this is the Daniel that lived maybe in the 5th or 6th century A.D., read the history books, and wrote all this stuff down from hindsight. We know that that's not true because significant portions of the book of Daniel have been found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, where carbon-14 dating tells us they were recorded in about 200 B.C. And if they were recorded in 200 B.C., then several of the events we're going to be reading about today happened after 200 B.C. So in that sense, we have clear proof that this must be a detailed fulfillment of prophecy, that there really is this book of truth where God has got recorded in advance all the significant events that will take place in human history. It's there. Now, the fact that we're talking about 200 B.C., really means that it must be the Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar's court. Because between 500 B.C. and 200 B.C., if anybody came forward with this kind of a book, he would have been immediately exposed as a fraud. Why? Because people would be so close to the events when they happen, they would recognize it. Well, the point is, the book of Daniel has never been challenged as a fraud. the contemporaries that did not rise up and say, this is phony, this isn't the Daniel that he claims to be. Now, we're talking 6th century A.D., we're now looking at 11, 12 centuries that have gone by, and then, you know, people might have forgotten. But if it's only 100 or 200 years, there's really no opportunity for a fraudulent book of Daniel to come forward and be accepted as part of the biblical canon. So that gives us some assurance that this really was written by the Daniel that is claimed here in the text, namely the Daniel who was prime minister over both the Babylonian Empire, and after the Babylonian Empire was defeated by the Persians, he was appointed prime minister of the Persian Empire. And as I mentioned last week, that's only happened once in human history, where the prime minister of one nation that was in great conflict with an opposing nation was made the prime minister of the opposing nation after that nation was victorious. It's only happened once in human history, and as this book points out, it happened because this Daniel was a man of exceptional integrity and talent. Everybody trusted him implicitly. He was very knowledgeable and wise, and when Darius took over the Babylonian Empire, he said, who do we have better to run the Persian Empire than this man that was running the Babylonian Empire? And was well aware, too, that the last king of Babylon failed to take the advice of Daniel. And he said, well, he was defeated because he wouldn't take Daniel's advice, but I'm going to take Daniel's advice. So he made him the prime minister. Okay, let's pick it up just before Daniel chapter 11. The angel is speaking to him, and so he said, the angel, do you know why I have come to you, Daniel? Soon I'll return to fight against the prince of Persia, and when I go, the prince of Greece will come. But first I will tell you what is written in the book of truth. No one supports me against them except Michael, your prince. And when he talks about them, he's referring to these demons, these fallen angels that are working behind the scenes with these rulers. And these last few chapters of Daniel are really telling what God did to prevent a world empire from coming upon the scene. Earlier in this book of Daniel, Daniel was told that God moved to prevent the Assyrians from dominating the nations of the world. And likewise, he would move to prevent the Babylonians from dominating the nations of the world. And now in this chapter 11, we're told that that's going to continue to be a policy of God, to always oppose that nation or that ruler that tries to dominate the nations of the world. And so Assyria rose up, and they thought they could take over the world, and God intervened to prevent that from happening. And you can read the book of Isaiah and see how God used the people of Judea, a very weak nation at the time, used the people of Judea to defeat the Assyrians and prevent them from dominating the world. And that's kind of what the book of Daniel documents here, is that we know this is God working behind the scenes to bring about the human historical events he wants, because we can always see the miraculous interventions. The Assyrians were defeated by something that could only be labeled an outright miracle. I mean, if you know the story, this huge army gathered around Jerusalem, the last city in the region of the Assyrian Empire that wasn't yet under their domination. They've conquered all the capital cities of all the nations around them. The last one left was Jerusalem, and the Assyrians had already taken over all the towns and villages of the Judeans except their capital city. So we have Jerusalem, the only place left. Now, was Jerusalem a powerful city at that time? They estimate its population at that time was probably 10,000 people total. So the number of troops, obviously, was much less than that 10,000. And they had a limited food supply. Now, they did have a good water supply, because one thing Hezekiah did is he blocked the pool, the spring of Gihon, and brought it into the city. Says, I don't want these Assyrians drinking our water. We're going to drink the water. And so the Assyrians had to keep going down to the Jordan River, had to get water for the troops that are around there. But if you recall a story recorded in the book of Isaiah, God came to Isaiah in answer to prayer and said, these Assyrian soldiers you're worried about, it's not going to happen. Go and talk to the king, King Hezekiah, and tell him that this huge, huge army will be gone, and Sennacherib, the king of the Assyrians, will be killed without you having to raise a finger. And says you're going to be able to beat these Assyrians again without having to raise a single sword. And that very night, 175,000 Assyrian soldiers got sick and died. And they woke up the next morning, saw the dead bodies, and Sennacherib said, I'm not going to take on this king of Jerusalem. He can kill 175,000 of my best soldiers in the middle of the night without raising a single sword. We're heading for home. And on the way home, he got killed. So everything that was told to Isaiah and given to Hezekiah came true exactly as is. Yes. Well, you know, angels are much more powerful than we are. But it tells us in the book of Hebrews that angels were created by God to serve human beings. So there are servants. It's hard to believe that we have these very powerful creatures that are in service to us. So they're there to assist. And as Hebrews goes on to say, many of us have entertained angels without knowing it. As I mentioned last week, an angel can take any physical form he wants. He can take the form of your automobile, your grandmother who passed away 30 years ago, or any other human being or any other physical form, a donkey, whatever. And we see instances of this in Scripture. Angels can do that. The fallen angels likewise can do that. You know, I write about this in Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, that what people think are UFOs really aren't UFOs. Well, 98% of them you can explain by natural means, but there's a 2% residual where people are coming into contact with these fallen angels. They can take that form. That really explains to you why UFOs have changed over the centuries. 120 years ago, UFOs were slow-moving dirigibles in the atmosphere. Today, they're craft moving at, quote, 25,000 miles per hour. They keep up with technology. So whatever will work to fool the human observer, they will use. And that's one of the signs that we're dealing with the evil angels rather than the good angels, is the fact that we can see the signs of deception, and we can also document that when people have these close encounters with UFOs, they suffer malicious effects. This is not a benign phenomena. It's something that will hurt you. Yes. Well, God created angels in the same form that he created human beings. He created these angels as free will beings, which means they could choose to obey the creator of the universe, or they could choose to disobey. And if you read the chapter 12 of the book of Revelation, it tells us that Lucifer was able to persuade one-third of the angels to rebel. Now, the difference is that these angels already have eternal life, and so they can't experience death. And because they can't experience death, and because they're not subject to the thermodynamic laws like we are and don't experience decay, they cannot receive grace from God. They can't be redeemed. So when those angels rebelled against God, it was permanent condemnation. So in that sense, we can be grateful that we experienced the decay of our bodies and the decay of everything around us and all the work we got to do to reverse that decay. A lot of us were talking last week about this guy Murphy who kind of makes things go bad all around us. Well, thank God for the second law of thermodynamics. Thank God that we get to experience physical death, because by that means we can be delivered, unlike the demons, from the consequences of spiritual death. So our spiritual death, if we so choose, can be temporary, whereas the spiritual death of the fallen angels is permanent. There is no redemption for the fallen angels. There is the possibility of redemption for human beings. So in that sense, we can look at physical death and at decay and disease as gifts from God that enable us to receive of his grace. There's a reason why he made his universe with gravity and thermodynamics and electromagnetism. Those are tools that he was able to use to rather rapidly and efficiently bring about a conquest of evil and suffering for the human species. But yeah, the angels are left out of this. And as it tells us in the book of Corinthians, the good angels out there, the ones that are in obedience to Jesus Christ and God the Father, they're intently watching and observing us human beings to learn about this mystery of the grace of God that delivers people who don't deserve the rewards of the kingdom of heaven. They can't figure it out. They're reserving us to try to figure it out. Now, we're still struggling to figure it out. I mean, grace is a very difficult thing to receive, this fact that we get all this stuff that we don't deserve. You know, we deserve condemnation. We don't get condemnation. We get rewards and an incredible career in a new creation if we so choose to go along that path. And it's a tremendous mystery why God would do that for some creature that so little deserves it. But we get to experience it. And because we get to experience it, we receive a training that the angels never receive. They're out there observing it. But you might want to think about that as you leave here today, that no matter where you go, there's a bunch of eyes watching you. The angels are watching everything you do. Not because they're so interested in all the gossip that goes on down here. They're trying to figure out this grace. They're watching God's grace minister through us, saying, we want to understand what's going on in these lowly human beings. But because we're the ones that experience grace, the angels are there to serve us. So it's not that we're to serve them. They're there to serve us. They're servants. Okay. And a servant was sent to Daniel to tell him what would happen in the future. This was meant to encourage Daniel and to encourage the Jews, because Daniel took this message and said, some bad stuff's going to happen to us, but in the end it's all going to turn out for good. God has told me. And so the Jews were prepared in advance for the terrible times that are about to befall them as a result of what would take place with the Persians and the Greeks and the Romans. Now that would follow them. So they had some advance warning. And they also had the news that something very good would come out of this. The Messiah would come, and the eventual setting up of a new Jewish nation that we've seen take place just in our lifetime today. All this is predicted here in Daniel 11 and 12. Let me get into the details. Okay. So the angel tells him, I had to first get into this battle, but now I've been free. I can tell you what's written in the book of truth. And in the first year of Darius the Mede, this message is given to Daniel. Now then, I tell you the truth. So the book of truth is now being opened up to Daniel. He says, three more kings will appear in Persia, and then a fourth will be far richer than all the others. Very specific prophecy. Okay, here's this first king of Persia. He's conquered the Babylonians. Now has set up an empire of 120 provinces throughout that part of the world, and dominates the world. It's now the dominant empire in the world. That's the first king. And that first king made Daniel the prime minister. But Daniel is told there will be three more kings after this that will appear, and there will be a fourth that will follow the three. And the fourth one will be the richest and the most powerful of all the five kings that ruled over the Persian Empire. But it says, when he has gained power by his wealth. And this seems to be something that demons are always doing. When a nation gains great power, demons begin to work to tempt the rulers of that nation to abuse their power. You know, and our own nation has to be careful about this. Because the United States today has no equal on the planet. There's no nation opposing us. And it'd be very tempting for our leaders to begin to abuse the overwhelming power that the United States wields in the world today. And just to put this in context, in terms of all these nations we're going to read about today, none of them were as militarily dominant as the United States is today. No nation in history has had the military dominance of the United States. Just to put this in context, the United States spends more money on its military than the rest of the nations combined. No nation comes close. By the way, we don't have the biggest army. There are other nations with much bigger armies than ours. But because of the money we spend on armaments, there's no nation on the planet that could ever pose a threat to us. And incidentally, Rome was in that same position. Not as dominant as the United States, but dominant to the point that no nation could ever face Rome on the military field. You know how the enemies of Rome struck out at Rome? Terrorism. Because they said there's no way we could raise an army to deal with Rome. The only way we can deal with Rome is through covert terrorism, which may explain what the situation the United States is doing today. Because there's no way the U.S. can be challenged on the field of battle, terrorism is being used by people who hate our objectives. But to me, what is scary is the fact that every nation who's become as dominant as the United States has abused its power. Leaders get tempted, and the power gets abused. So something we need to be in prayer about, that wouldn't happen to us. Now then, I tell you the truth. Three more kings will appear in Persia, and then a fourth will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, rather than being content with the wealth and the power, 120 provinces, all the money he wanted, he should have said, you know, let's just be content. But instead, he got concerned about this little small nation of Greece. And Greece was beginning to trade with some of the cities on the western coast of Asia Minor, what is now Turkey. And that really bothered this powerful king of Persia and said, we want all the trade. And so over a trading dispute, he raised an army of 2 million troops to advance against the Greeks. And not all of them made it in there, but you know the story. You read the history books. It says, when he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. So here's this little small nation of Greece, an emerging nation. And here the king of Persia spends all his money, goes throughout the 120 provinces, and raises up this army of 2 million troops, and then begins to advance on Greece. And when he moved into Greece, he was defeated. And my sons today are going to be watching this movie called The 300. And you know, it's distorted, I can tell you. I had to kind of talk to my son and say it's not quite the way it happened. But the way it did happen, nevertheless, was spectacular, and you could argue miraculous. 300 soldiers held off these forces of the Persian king until the Greeks had time to raise up an army of 10,000. With an army of 10,000, they were able to defeat a force that was much bigger than theirs and send the king of Persia packing. But what happened? The Greeks kind of said, all right, we beat off the Persians, let's just settle down to a nice economy. But they started to squabble with one another. They weren't content. And you know the Peloponnesian Wars. And how the Peloponnesian Wars ended, this king of Macedonia came in and said, well, they're going to squabble. How about if we just take them over and all settle the peace that way? And it worked. And so then we have this mighty king will appear who will rule with great power and do as he pleases, referring to Alexander the Great. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken out and parceled out toward the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. And again, that's exactly how it happened. There was no need for Alexander the Great to go after the Persians. He had everything he wanted. He could have just kind of let things be. But again, there are demonic forces at work. And they were motivating him, saying, okay, we're going to go after the Persians. And so he went into Asia Minor, fought these battles, and wound up taking over the entire Persian Empire and more. Not just the 120 provinces. He even had plans to go into India and China and conquer India and China. So he was at the border of India. And, you know, his soldiers had been marching for 10 years. And they said, we've conquered these 120 provinces. We've conquered Bactria. We've conquered all these other nations. You know what? We want to go back home to our families. 10 years is a long time to be marching through here. And, you know, we've lost people. And, you know, we need to go back home. And so the generals got together with Alexander and said, you're not crossing the Indus River. You've got to stop. And so fine, he stopped. Then he got the flu, got sick, and at age 33, he died. And so what happened to the Persian Empire, or the Alexander's Empire? And to this day, it ranks as encompassing more land area than any of their empire has ever been able to achieve, at least by direct rule. You could argue the British Empire was bigger, but it got bigger because it gave independence the different portions of its empire. This is a complete rule. But after Alexander died, the four generals got together and said, let's just split it up. And that's exactly what they did. The four generals split up Alexander's empire into four pieces. And the rest of the Daniel 11 talks about what happened between the different pieces. But notice what the text says. It says it'll be parceled out towards the four winds of heaven. A reference to the fact that Alexander's empire would now become four separate pieces. And you know your history. One piece was a Ptolemaic empire, which was basically Egypt, and kind of encompassed the lands that... Because what this text talks about are the battles, the intrigues, the deceit, the marriages, and the plans going on between the king of the south and the king of the north. And just so you got your history straight, the king of the south is the Ptolemaic or the Egyptian Empire. Now, the king of the north is the Syrian Empire. Now, the Syrian Empire was a little bit bigger than the Egyptian Empire. Basically encompassed most of the Persian Empire. So it included... the Babylonian region, Mesopotamia, Persia, Syria, and Turkey was all included in that. And they said, what about the other two pieces? Well, one piece was basically the Greek and the Macedonian piece. And then the fourth piece was a little piece that was near the border of India, a little bit of what we now know as Afghanistan. Those were the four pieces. But the two dominant pieces were the Egyptians and the Syrians, the king of the north and the king of the south. Now, let's just read what it says here about these kings. Then a mighty king will appear, who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out towards the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. As this book of Daniel points out, God sends his angels to prevent any nation from dominating the rest of the world. As I mentioned last week, this is just basic antitrust legislation. If you got one nation that controls the peoples of the world, that single nation will abuse its power and begin to make things oppressive for the citizens of that nation, the nations around them. So God always wants to make sure that nations have competition. And so he raises up competition. And that's what he did here. Now there's four nations instead of one nation. And they begin to compete against one another. Okay, it starts off with the king of the south. Because the king of the south, that's Egypt, will become strong. But one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power. So it's making a prediction that it will be this king of the south, but one of the generals of this king of the south will actually take over the kingdom. And will depose the king, and will take over. He'll rule his own kingdom with great power. After some years, they'll become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance. And this repeatedly happened between these two nations. Things were going on, looked like they were going to unite, and again set up the empire of Alexander. Because as time went on, the Greek part got weaker and weaker, and the part over by India got weaker and weaker. The Syrians got stronger and stronger. The Egyptians got stronger and stronger. And every once in a while, the king of the south and the king of the north would get together and say, let's join forces. And then we can have this world empire again. But every time they decided to join forces, something happened to prevent that from taking place. So after some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance. But she will not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. So they tried it, and things happened to prevent that from taking place. In those days, she'll be handed over, together with her royal escort and her father, and the one who supported her. One from her family line will arise to take her place. He will attack the forces of the king of the north. So that puts an end to the alliance. So instead of this marriage solving everything, a family, a relative, rises up and deposes her, kills her, and the father, who tried to set up this alliance, and then immediately begins to attack the king of the north. So alliance is gone. It's over. He will attack the forces of the king of the north and enter his fortress, which means Damascus. And he will fight against them and be victorious. He will also seize their gods, their metal images, and their valuable articles of silver and gold, and carry them off to Egypt. For some years, he will leave the king of the north alone. Then the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south, but will retreat to his own country. His sons will prepare for war and assemble a great army, which will sweep on like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south will march out in a rage and fight against the king of the north, who will raise a large army, but it will be defeated. When the army is carried off, the king of the south will be filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands. Yet he will not remain triumphant, for the king of the north will muster another army, larger than the first, and after several years he will advance with a huge army, fully equipped. In those times, many will rise up against the king of the south, which means the king of the north gets allies, gets an even bigger army. The violent men amongst your own people, that is the Jews, will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. Then the king of the north will come and build up siege ramps and will capture a fortified city. The forces of the south will be powerless to resist. Even their best troops will not have the strength to stand. The invader will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land, that's a reference to Israel, and will have power, and will have the power to destroy it. So the Jewish province here gets destroyed. Their self-government is taken away from them. He will determine to come with the might of his entire empire and will make an alliance with the king of the south. So once again, they try to set up an alliance. Let's establish his world empire again. But his plans will not succeed. He will make an alliance with the king of the south, and he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom. So what he does is he gives him his daughter in marriage. They're going to set up an alliance, but his real plan was to use his daughter to take over where he alone would have all the power. Okay. We'll give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom, but his plans will not succeed or help him. Then he will turn his attention to the coastlands and will take many of them. Okay, what's that reference to the coastlands? That's referring to the peoples of the West. Rome is just beginning to emerge as a power at this point. It becomes a threat to the Syrians. And so the Syrians, wanting to maintain control over the trade in the Mediterranean, they go out to attack the coastal colonies of the Romans. And the Romans were good at that. You know, they would kind of send people out and begin to set up colonies in Spain and Greece and North Africa. And so the Syrians go after those colonists. So now Rome gets into the picture. Then he'll turn his attention to the coastlands and will take many of them. But a commander will put an end to his insolence and turn his insolence back upon him. Basically, the Romans say, hey, you can't do this to us. And they push the Syrians back to their former borders and regain their colonies. And then Rome kind of settled back again. Said, okay, we'll just forget about him. After this, he'll turn back towards the fortresses of his own country, but will stumble and fall and be seen no more, referring to the king of the north. His successor will send out a tax collector. Isn't that interesting? Successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person, someone who is very wicked, who has not been given the honor of royalty, so is not a member of the royal family. He seizes power through intrigue. He will invade the kingdom when its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. Both it and a prince of the covenant will be destroyed. And this is all recorded in the history books, how he had a small army, took on a huge army, but the small army defeated the huge army. And an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. Both it and a prince of the covenant will be destroyed, after coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully, and with only a few people, he will rise to power. When the richest provinces feel secure, he will invade them and will achieve what neither his fathers nor his forefathers did. He will distribute plunder, loot, and wealth amongst his followers. He will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. For a brief period of time, he takes over complete power. Finally achieves what the king of the north and king of the south tried to do through alliances. He does it with a small army and a few followers, but only for a brief period of time. With a large army, so now he has a small army, but now he raises a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. The king of the south will wage war with a large and very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. Those who eat from the king's provisions will try to destroy him, so he is swept from inside. His army will be swept away. Many will fall in battle. The two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and lie to each other. Does that ever happen in politics? Where you get two leaders from opposing sides and get together for a dinner and... Okay, the two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table, lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will come at the appointed time. The king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the holy covenant. He will take action against it, then return to his own country. So that's the downfall of the king of the north. He goes after Jerusalem and after the temple, and as this text goes on, he performs the abomination of desolation, basically slaughters a pig in the holy of holies of the temple of the Jews, which is the worst thing he could ever do to the Jews. Yes. All this is stuff that has happened. Now, when did that happen? Okay. I don't know the name of the tax collector. Now, if you want deep... Oh, the one who sent the tax collector. Okay, that's the king of the north. The king of the north sends out this tax collector. Okay. What I'm going to do, if you want detailed documentation of this, you can go to any good history book of that era. But there's actually one you'll find in every Catholic Bible. And the Catholic Bibles, they've got these apocryphal books, and 1st and 2nd Maccabees give a detailed recording of all this history. So Maccabees was written with hindsight. Daniel was written with foresight. Daniel wrote before the events took place. 1st and 2nd Maccabees record in detail the events after they have taken place. And you can compare the two. Now, Maccabees is not inspired scripture, but most scholars consider it to be a faithful recording of the historical events. And you can get and check it out with any good history book of that era. It's basically the pre-Roman era that you're looking at. But yeah, I did not come here today with all the names of all the different kings. The book of Maccabees actually gives you, actually names all the individuals who are prophesied here in this text. Okay, where am I here? Return to his country. Okay, at the appointed time, the king of the north, verse 29, will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different from it was before. Ships of the western coastlands, again a reference to the Romans, ships of the western coastlands will oppose him, and he will lose heart. At this point, the Roman Empire is starting to become significantly powerful on the earthly field, and they had this trade set up with North Africa. North Africa now became the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. That's where all their wheat came from, and they wanted to maintain those trade routes, and they looked at the king of the north as a threat to that, and they saw the king of the north coming in to conquer the Egyptians. They said, we don't want that to happen. Rome had made a strategic decision to make sure that the king of the north and the king of the south kept fighting one another. They said, if they keep fighting one another, then we can gradually increase our strength and become the dominant power. But if they unite, then we got a problem. And so Rome's strategy for a couple hundred years was to make sure that they allied themselves with the weaker of the two nations that were fighting one another. Kind of similar to the British strategy for several hundred years in Europe. In notice how Britain always allied themselves with a nation that was under threat of being conquered by a more powerful nation. Rome used the same strategy. You know, it's a great strategy to use if you're trying to maintain your position of strength. So that's what Rome did. They bided their time until they would be strong enough to dominate both the king of the north and the king of the south. And so their strategy at this time was just to keep them in conflict with one another, make sure they don't unite. And so that's why the Roman navy came in and opposed the king of the north and prevented their conquest of the Egyptian empire. And that's well recorded in history. Any book of history of the Roman Empire will document this for you. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him, and he will lose heart. Then he will turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. And so that's what this king of the north did. He says, okay, the Romans have stopped me from conquering Egypt. I'm going to take this out on the Jews and their system of worship. And so that's exactly what he did. He returned to the nation of Israel and began to wreak havoc against the Jews. And this is where the book of Maccabees, especially 2 Maccabees, will give you a detailed documentation of what took place there. And he vents his fury against the Holy Covenant. He'll return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Again, Maccabees documents that, how the king of the north came in there and basically made an alliance with all the apostate Jews. Says, okay, you don't like these rabbis, we're going to help you, as long as you join in with us. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Now, keep in mind, no one had ever done that to the Jews before. Yeah, they may have conquered their nation, but they never dared to go into the temple and desecrate the temple. That was always considered off limits. And by the way, when the Romans came in, they made very sure that none of their soldiers ever went into the temple. They said, we're going to respect that. We're not going to cause a problem for the Jews. But this king of the Syrian empire, he decided to go straight into the temple with the soldiers and did away with the daily sacrifice and really offended the Jews by sacrificing a pig on the altar in the Holy of Holies. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. And that's what that term refers to. Sacrificing, a quote, an unclean animal in the Holy of Holies. With flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant. But the people who know their God will firmly resist him. So he divided Jew against Jew. He gave wealth and flattery to those Jews that were apostate and resisted those who were trying to oppose him. Verse 33, those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. And again, the book of Maccabees documents that this was a time of great spiritual revival amongst the Jews. At the worst moment, when their temple was desecrated and all these apostate Jews were given positions of power and wealth, this is when revival began to break out amongst the Jews. And for a short time, the Jews really began to live a holy lifestyle before God. When they fall, they'll receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble, so they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. And again, what the Maccabean books will document for you is that there was a brief period when the Jewish zealots, those who were true to the Word of God, rose up and threw off the shackles of their oppression. And what happened? The apostate Jews joined the righteous Jews. And so the Maccabean books document how these apostate Jews simply went the direction the wind blowed. When the Assyrians were dominant, they allied themselves with them. When the Jewish religious zealots were dominant, they allied themselves with them. They just go back and forth. Yes. The former is correct. It was a pragmatic move, and that's something that was unique about the Roman Empire. Unlike the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Persians and the Greeks before them, they said, we're going to rule at minimal cost. And how are we going to rule at minimal cost? All these nations that we conquer, we're going to basically give them what they want. We're not going to oppress them. What we're going to do is set up economic agreements with them. Yeah, we're going to collect taxes from them, but we're going to give them good infrastructure. We'll build roads and things. And so they tried to take a, quote, benevolent approach towards those nations that they conquered. And the reason for that is they didn't want to maintain an army of more than 100,000 troops. So that costs a lot of money. And one reason why they were able to keep it at just 100,000 is that we're going to build a good road system and a transportation system, but for that to work, they needed the support of the nations they conquered. So that was the policy of the Romans for 800 years, that the people they conquered, they would basically make a, quote, good deal with them so that they could maintain, keep the costs of their rule at a reasonable level. Very different from, say, what Hitler did when he conquered the nations. You know, he just went through the total oppression, but wound up spending a lot of money and manpower ruling over, say, well, I mean, you know, if you're a student of World War II, Hitler needed 30 divisions to keep Yugoslavia under his thumb. Those 30 divisions prevented him from beating the Russians. And if he had been kind towards the Yugoslavs and gave them what they wanted, he might, the outcome of World War II could have been very different. But that's kind of how, I mean, France was the same problem. I mean, instead of working a good deal out, it wound up costing a lot of money. But Rome kind of learned that. Yes. 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 Right. Right. Okay. And by the way, with this new room arrangement here, my peripheral vision can't pick up all of you. So you're sitting at the fringes here. Someone else is going to have to tell me. And I notice all the questions are coming where my peripheral vision doesn't reach. So, but yeah, I was wondering why. And this class is different. I'm not getting quite as many questions from here, but it's at the peripheral vision. So you're going to have to help me with this. We're out of time. But I think we're far enough along. What I want to do next time is that right about verse 34, 35, 36 down to 40, it transitions from the period of the Greeks and the Romans to the modern day. So there's a sharp transition here. And a lot of people put it at verse 36. Some people put it at verse 40. So we'll get into the discussion. And that's kind of what Daniel's talking about here, how this battle that takes place amongst the angels, the good and bad angels, over who's going to dominate the nations of the world. This continues, according to Daniel, through all of human history. But at one point, the angel jumps from the events that are just several hundred years in advance of the Prime Minister Daniel, right up to the days that are not yet been fulfilled. So some of this stuff here has yet to take place. The latter part of Daniel 11 and the early part of Daniel 12 is future prophecy. But that's standard for the Bible when it talks about future prophecy. It frequently talks about two things at once, an event that's relatively short term and an event that's really far term. If you want a good example of that, consider the prophecy that was given to Isaiah. A virgin will give birth to a child. And you read that prophecy in Isaiah 6 and 7, you notice there's two different names for the child. One child is the child that would be born to the virgin that was soon to be married to Isaiah. And it says, when that child is born, and when that child is able to know right from wrong, the Assyrians that are attacking will be gone. But then it refers to another child who has a different name, Emmanuel. And that's a child that will be born to a virgin hundreds of years later. But that's the pattern of Bible prophecy. Likewise with the Olivet Discourse. You know, the disciples asked Jesus two questions. When will this temple be destroyed? And when will the time of the end come? Well, they thought both of them would be at the same time. They didn't realize those would be two very time-separated events. But Jesus gave one prophecy that fulfills or pertains to both events. that's standard, and it's likewise here in the book of Daniel. So two different, one set of prophecy does two different jobs. We'll pick that up next time we study this. Let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you that you've packed into this book, the Bible, clear evidence that this is a book of truth. How you successfully predict future scientific discoveries, but also future historical events. And in both cases with such astounding detail that we cannot doubt that there is this book of truth where everything has been predetermined. Scientifically, historically, every event that takes place in our own lives as individual human beings. That's all written in this book. And we thank you, Lord, that you're a God that takes control to that degree. And Lord, we right now just want to tell you that we're going to trust our future life to you, moment by moment, and recognize that whatever happens to us, it's because you're working events out for your purpose and your good. And Lord, I pray that you would help us to withstand the suffering and the trials that take place as you bring about your will in our lives and the lives of those people around us. But Father, we ask that you would use us in a mighty way to bring your life, love, and truth to people around us that don't yet have that relationship with you. In Jesus' name, amen. That was the first 300,
yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Right. Hi.
I'm on the fringe, you can't see.
Right.
I'm fasting. Do you think fasting is spiritual discipline because God is, God sees our suffering and somehow impressed that we're that determined? Or is it more that we, in a practice, that we're freed up in time to pray?
Well, I think it's the latter, in the sense that through fasting, we're able to, because, you know, the condition is God will answer any prayer you make according to his will. But, you know, if we're rather sloppy about the way we pray, we may not have a very good grasp on his will, and therefore we are not able to pray with any real power or conviction. And through fasting, we actually put aside...